It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Mid-July is time for reds to rush into Coconut and up the Kenai River. And at the river's mouth to navigate their way past a phalanx of nets held out in the current on long poles. Today we're talking about dip netting, the kind of fishing that makes you feel like a grizzly bear, snatching the salmon out of the river by skill and chance. Some don't call it sport, but there is definitely technique involved, and the lust of the hunt is strong when you're pulling them in one after another. We'll be covering how to dip net the Kenai and the impact on residents of riverside craziness as thousands of people converge on a small area and clean many thousands of fish. And I've got some excellent guests to talk about dip netting today. In the studio with me is Tim Wilson, who is a fisherman. He also sells the gear at B&J Sporting Goods and a true expert on the topic. Thanks for being with me, Tim.
Thank you.
And on the line with us from Kenai is Kenai City Manager Rick Cook, who is has to deal with all the people who descend upon the community in search of that free food and the fun of catching reds. Thanks for being with us, Rick.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So, Rick, we were talking very briefly before we went on the air of just the sheer number of people who come into your community to do this. I mean, this is a huge deal.
It is a huge deal. It becomes quite the event at the mouth of the Kenai River in a fairly compact area. We'll have as many as 15,000 people there in the course of a day.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's pretty busy. You look down the bluff, it looks like a little Woodstock going on down there.
And some real impacts for the community that you have to manage.
Yeah, certainly, both positive and negative. The state of Alaska has provided some funding for a few improvements that help there, but for the most part, all of the outhouses and solid waste kinds of things are all are paid for by the users through fees. And just for an example, for the 3 weeks, I just signed the contract the other day, $72,000 for dumpsters for just 3 weeks.
Wow, that's a lot of garbage. Tim, you go down there, you enjoy dip netting, and it seems like it's a whole community scene. I mean, it's not like remote fishing, that's for sure.
No, it's definitely not. It's a big family thing. Lots of cars, lots of people. People working in teams. It's huge. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So the experience of dip netting is really different from rod and reel fishing.
Absolutely. It's a totally different thing. A lot more people. A lot more fish getting processed at one time. More expensive gear. But a bigger payoff in the end.
Yeah, well, you're getting you're getting food for the whole winter.
Absolutely. I mean, you're allowed 25 per person and then 10 extra for the head of household.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little bit of a quick primer on how you are successful dip netting. I mean, what is it? What are some of the things you need to do to get out there and actually catch a fish?
Well, first of all, you have to have the right gear. The right gear makes everything a lot easier. You have to have at least a couple people with you. A single person dip netting can be difficult.
Right, because you're gonna get a bunch of fish. You got to get them on shore, kill them, cut them, do all the work. But meanwhile, there's more fish swimming by. You need to get back out there with your net.
Absolutely. You need to get back out there before someone takes your spot.
Yeah. So how does that work? Are you people standing in line to grab a spot?
At times it can be like that. The beach can get pretty crowded. But it's such a large spans of beach. I'm sure you can find somewhere where you're not competing mm-hmm. all the time.
And what's the social atmosphere? Is it kind of fun and positive, or do people get a little competitive?
It can get competitive at times, but mostly it's a big family atmosphere. Everyone's kind of focused on their own fish. I rarely see arguments down at the beach. I mean, it's like I said, it's a big family atmosphere.
Yeah. What's the best fishing you ever saw down there?
The best fishing I ever saw was people pulling in five at a time.
Yeah.
And it seemed like every single net was going. As soon as you get in the water, fish on. That's the best I've ever seen.
So you go down there with three or four family members, you could like have 100 fish within, an hour.
Yeah, more fish than you could possibly carry.
So that's the other issue. Like, what do you do with all these fish, right?
With all the fecal coliform thing that's been going on, that big scare, a lot of people, what I recommend is getting the fish and then dropping their guts right there on the beach, or and then bringing the fish back to your truck to process later. I wouldn't process them on the beach.
Right, because the water's just kind of dirty.
Yeah, I'd bring like a wagon or something with me. You can drive your vehicle out on the South Shore, but I'd bring a four-wheel drive. If you don't have a four-wheel drive, I'd bring some sort of wagon or something you can carry them back, or a cooler mm-hmm. with wheels.
Mm-hmm. So Rick, city manager down in Kenai, this issue of the water quality in the Kenai River is one that's been in the news recently, that there is some what fecal coliform, which I guess come from feces, animal or human. How is that getting in the river? Is that a concern or an issue that needs to be addressed?
I think if you care for your harvest in an appropriate manner, it is not an issue. I have to answer the last question first. Mm-hmm. As far as where is it coming from? There is a fairly significant nesting community of birds on the South Shore of the river upstream of this area, and the most likely culprit for the coliform and enterococci bacteria are those birds. The DEC did DNA testing on 55 samples. 53 were fish, or excuse me, 53 were from birds, and one was from a dog, and one was from a human. So probably anomalies, just outliers. It's a naturally occurring event. I mean, this isn't something that's new this year, last year, or 100 years ago. I mean, it's something that is going to happen when you have a population of birds like that. Now, it becomes exacerbated during the fishery when folks are cleaning fish and leaving their fish guts just laying on the beach instead of putting them in the river. And we've changed the ordinance this year that if you don't take your fish waste and put it in the river, you can be cited, and there's a fine that goes along with that. And we're not interested in writing tickets. We want compliance.
Mm-hmm.
We'll still have fish back up on the tide line on the tide, but we have tractors with rakes, and we try and rake it back down as low down the beach as possible during low tides. So it's a naturally occurring event. There's not anything we can really do about it. Now, the Department of Environmental Conservation is who has the experts in that area, and if those levels, even though they exceed EPA water quality standards, if they get to a point where it requires action, the Department of Environmental Conservation is a regulatory agency that would be responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. But if you're a fisherman, really, like Tim, as Tim was saying, you want to bleed the fish, gut the fish, and then take it somewhere else to fillet it with fresh, pure water. I mean, and that's the solution.
Yeah, I mean, I would. If it was me doing it, I'd gut and gill them right there, and I'd take them with me. But sometimes the sheer volume of fish that people get, it becomes somewhat more problematic to take fish in that. And there was long discussion with the city council and I this winter about whether or not we were going to even allow that activity to take place on the beach. And one of the options was you had to take the whole fish with you, and you could have gutted it on the beach, but you had to take the guts along with you. And we felt that would probably end up in just moving a problem down the road between here and Anchorage.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, I'm grateful that wasn't the option that was selected.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it works this year. I mean, it's a pretty hideous place when all those fish guts are sitting on the beach. There's anywhere from 600,000 to 1.2 million pounds of fish waste that's generated during this fishery.
Oh my gosh, that's almost unimaginable.
It is. I mean, I've got stacks and stacks of pictures of what things look like down there, and it's not very attractive.
It's turned into a pretty big part of your job, hasn't it?
Well, it certainly takes up your whole month of July.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much all of our parks and rec people. We have six seasonal enforcement officers that we bring on during that period of time. Our staffing is probably in the 40s of people that are just dedicated to trying to manage the fishery, manage our part of the fishery. The fishery itself, the rules are all state rules, and we don't have anything to do with that. But we own all of the property that the fishery takes place on. We own the bottom of the river, we own the beaches, tidelands, uplands. So it all takes place on properties owned by the city of Kenai.
All you don't own is the water and the fish, I guess. So we're talking about Kenai River dip netting on Outdoor Explorer today. I'm Charles Wolforth. And you've just been hearing from Rick Cook, who's the city manager of Kenai. And in the studio with me is Tim Wilson, who's a fisherman and also sells the gear and knows how to build it. He works at B&J Sporting Goods here in Anchorage. Tim, I'm wondering about the folks down there who maybe are causing some of the problems. And this is just my speculation, but I've noticed in a lot of situations like this, there'll be maybe most people are taking care of their fish guts, taking care of their situation. They know how to do it. And then there'll be other people who maybe things get a little out of control. Maybe they harvest more fish than they can handle. That's easy to do. Have you seen that? Do you have a sense of like who's causing the problems?
Mostly people that are uninformed when they go down there are the people that are harvesting over their limits or harvesting more fish than they can handle. A lot of people don't really understand the amount of fish. 25 fish doesn't sound like a lot, but when you actually get that out, you know, that's 50 fillets. That's quite a bit of fish. You know, that's more fish than I can eat over a winter time. You know, end up taking those fish and giving them away to families, you know.
Mm-hmm. So how many fish would you actually go for?
For me, a perfect number for over the winter, I have, you know, and that's including rod and reel and everything, is, you know, 25 to 30 fish, you know, for the whole summer, as far as my salmon supply goes. And then, you know, I'll get a bunch of halibut and rockfish too, you know.
Yeah, that's too bad when people go for more fish than they can really handle and then it goes to waste.
A lot of people do end up throwing away, cleaning out their freezers at the end of the year and throwing away a lot of good fish. So, you know, I just recommend that don't take more fish than, you know, you can possibly eat over the winter.
Mm-hmm. So when you get all these fish home, then you're filleting them. And do you use that, you know, I've heard the sort of the Russian River fillet where basically you take a long, sharp fillet knife, you just sort of cut at the top of the behind the gills and just run it back, and you don't worry too much about getting into the, you know, getting that little bit of meat that's right against the backbone. Do you do that, or do you like work your way down and make sure you get every single little bit of meat?
What I do is I first flip the fish over, cut the belly meat off because I like to smoke the belly meat, mm-hmm. and then I'll go right from the gill raker down to the spine and then across the spine all the way to the tail, and you should hear a clicking noise all the way down to the tail. Mm-hmm. If you do that properly, there is very little wasted.
Yeah. And how long does it take you to, I mean, you've got to, I've been up all night and I do actually most of my, or basically all of my dip netting I've done down in Kachemak Bay where there's a little creek, so it's a totally different deal. Do you know about that China Poot?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. Unfortunately, it's nowhere near as good as it used to be, but
no.
I mean, you get way more fish, you know, you get excited, you get a ton of fish, and then you're up all night.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened to me.
Absolutely. You're going to be processing fish for a while, especially if you don't want to fillet and freeze all the fillets. There's canning and smoking too. So, you know, there's a whole process that goes into those methods too. You know, you have to clean the fish, put it in jars, can it, or you have to brine it and smoke it, and that can take a while.
Yeah, you know, well, so that's all part of being Alaskan.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where can people just come into the store and get advice on all this stuff?
Absolutely. You can ask anybody at the store. We're all very knowledgeable, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Mm-hmm. And sell the little chief smokers and that kind of
thing. Yeah, we sell everything, wood chips, smokers. The only thing we don't sell is canners. You know, you have to go to Walmart or something for mm-hmm. that.
And are people still using those vacuum pack machines?
Absolutely. That's probably the most effective way of storing your salmon. Cleaning it off, patting it dry, putting it in a vacuum bag, vacuum sealing it, and then deep freezing it.
Mm-hmm. And how much does one of those machines go for?
They range. My girlfriend picked one up for $75. We've been using it for a year now. We've been really happy with it. But they can range all the way into the $600, $800 range, right, for commercial quality.
That's where you have to borrow one from a friend.
That's correct. Yeah.
Well, there's another way of doing it that, I don't know that everybody knows this, but somebody taught it to me and I found it worked pretty good, which is when you're out in the field and you don't have a vacuum packer and you want to try to do it, you can, you know, if you fillet that fish, obviously you want to do it in a clean place with good water.
Absolutely.
Then you just use a Ziploc bag and dip the bag into a bucket of water so that the water has the opportunity to force the air out of the bag, and then seal it and then pull it up. And it's almost like it's vacuum packed. There's no air left against the fish if you do it the right. And that works pretty good. I found that worked pretty well over the years.
Absolutely. The trick is making sure the bag is totally sealed so no air pulls back into the bag.
Right, right. And then because if you are waiting until next May to eat that fish, if it's freezer burned, it's just horrible.
Absolutely. It turns kind of a chalky color. Mm-hmm. It's gross.
All right. Well, we're talking about dip knitting today. You've been hearing Tim Wilson, who's a fisherman, and he's with B&J Sporting Goods. And Rick Cook is the Kenai City Manager, is on the phone with us from Kenai. And now from Soldotna, I'd like to welcome to the air Robert Begich, who is a biologist who oversees sport fishing there in that part of Alaska. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Begich.
You bet. How's everybody doing today?
Oh, doing good. Doing good. Everybody's excited about fishing. So this is... we call this personal use. I mean, we've got four categories, right? Commercial, subsistence, sport, and then personal use isn't really exactly sport. I mean, it's more like getting food for your family.
Right. It's a personal use fishery. It's the Kenai Kasilof River area and there's a few other locations in Cook Inlet that are designated as personal use fisheries, in state regulation.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a special part of the law where the legislature decided people ought to be able to get fish basically for meat just for their own families, and only Alaskans can do it, right?
Correct. It's only for Alaska residents. There's requirements for it that are explicit in our regulation booklet. If you folks review pages 13 through 15 of this South Central Sport Fishing Regulation Summary Booklet, it covers all that, and Alaska residency is the key, as well as other requirements, sport fishing license.
Mm-hmm. We'll have that linked up on our website at alaskapublic.org. If people want to check it out, just click on today's show, and we'll have the link to the regulations and to all the other information we're talking about today. So in terms of a license, all you need is a regular sport fishing license. The resident, it's like $15.
Yeah, you've got to have the sport fishing license, and if you fall under the license requirement, people that are over 60 years of age, they'll have their permanent identification card. That's the what we call the Z card or PID card. It's the free sport fishing license that folks that are old enough can get. You need that or a sport fishing license if you fall under the requirement of needing a sport fishing license greater than 16. People who don't have, who are less than 16, need to be named on their household permit while participating. There's a few nuances to that, depending on how people fall into that category. People that are participating in dip netting, who are over the age of 16, who are named on a permit, still need to possess a sport fishing license when they are dip netting.
All right. Now tell me about the permit.
The permit, it's a real simple permit. You can get at any licensed vendor. Not all of them carry them, but most of them do. And then at department offices, when you come in to get a permit from the office here, there's two pieces to it. There's what we call the overlay, which is all the personal information, the name, address, city, Alaska driver's license number, your sport fishing license number, and then a signature. Then you get the actual permit in hand, and that has your name on it, and then the individual members of the household who are also fishing under that permit.
I got you. So,
and then the recording boxes for when, if you do participate in a fishery, you record your harvest by day and location, Kenai River, Fish Creek, or Kasilof River. And then, even if you don't fish, you have to just check the box saying you did not fish this year.
I got you. So, and is there any charge for the permit, or is that free?
The permits are free.
But if you fish without one, you're breaking the law.
Correct. You know, the regulations for the personal use permit and personal use fishing on the Kenai, for example, they're pretty straightforward. They're explicit. They're what we call strict liability regulations, where either you do or you don't. You have to have a permit, and yet there's marking and recording requirements for the fishery.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Correct.
You're responsible to know. All right, okay. So explain to me how the area or the geography around the mouth of the river where people can fish. It's a somewhat constricted area.
Well, people fish in a constricted area. The area open to depth netting is actually fairly large. It extends from the area that's closed to commercial fishing, you know, way out on the Kenai beaches, beyond the mouth of the river, around a mile or so on either side of the mouth of the river, actually. So when you move into the river mouth, there's limitations on where you can fish and how you can fish. For example, when we get up above the city dock is where dip netting from a boat is allowed, and that's the only place it's allowed. So upstream of the city dock to the Warren Ames Bridge is open to both shore and dip netting, but that is the only area you can dip net from a boat.
I see.
Yep, and then as you move downstream of the city dock, there, the north bank of the river is closed to dip netting from shore all the way down to what we call the Nose Creek area below Main Street. That whole bluff area is closed to dip netting from shore. Then after that, it's all shore dip netting on the city property and out on those beaches.
And then there's some dip netting on the south side of the river as well?
Correct. The area open to dip netting goes both ways for in that area that's closed to commercial fishing. Those markers, it's about a mile and a half either side of the river mouth, but you never see people out beyond that.
And people, I don't know, anybody chime in who knows the answer to this, but people are choosing to just be in that one spot because that's the best spot, obviously.
You know, that's where we always see folks, is right on the north and south shores, or of course, in the boat dip net fishery, and then there's a few scattered up around the Warren Ames Bridge where there's easy access.
Uh-huh. Tim, would you agree with that? Those are just the spots where the fish are?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Rick?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's some practical limitations as well. There are mud flats that run out on, you know, both sides of the mouth as you get a little further out of the mouth. So, I mean, there are areas that are not as easily accessed, and certainly as the tide goes out, they become much less attractive to be standing out there in the mud.
So, season is like a 3-week season. Is that correct, Robert? And that's determined by regulation as to when it opens and closes, or is there any wiggle room on that?
It's the standard normal regulation for Kenai is begins July 10th at 6 a.m. And it closes daily at 11 p.m. And the season ends at 11 p.m. on July 31st.
And you are, the biologists are watching the escapement, and I know they sometimes make adjustments, allow it to go 24 hours or extend it a little bit, depending if they've got a lot of fish like they did last year?
Correct. If the department determines that the optimum escapement goal for Kenai River late-run sockeye salmon will be achieved, the liberalization to the personal use fishery that we've used, I believe we've used it consecutively the last 3 years, allows the fishery to operate 24 hours per day from when that is determined through the remainder of the fishery on July 31.
Mm-hmm. And is there somewhere where folks can go to find out, you know, what the current status is, whether it's been extended or there's an emergency order? I guess your website, and that stuff that's posted, we can link to that. And also, you know, is there sonar reports and that kind of information that you guys make available?
Yeah, the Division of Commercial Fisheries, I'll start with kind of the in-season run information, like current status of the run. Folks can, you know, it's a lot of it is word of mouth and just general run timing of when the fish usually get here, sometime around mid-month historically. So there's the Commercial Fish Division sockeye assessment. They have the sonar counter at River Mile 19, and that information is posted daily. It's also updated on the Fish and Game Fish Count Hotline at 262-9097. The emergency order information is we generally post signs letting the public know, and we also have a web page where we post notice when the emergency orders are issued.
And how is the year shaping up? And you know, we're talking about dip netting, but let's talk about kings as well. What's the year been like down there?
Very slow for kings, low abundance of king salmon, including our late run. For sockeye, the run forecast is very similar to last year that the Division of Commercial Fisheries has put out, so anticipating another good year for in-river sockeye fishing, including the dip net fishery.
Anything else you want to add, Robert, from the fish and game perspective?
Yeah, I would. I would just like to add that folks need to really pay attention to the marking requirements on the permits. When I say marking, that includes recording your harvest on the card and clipping the tail fins of your fish before you leave the fishing site. Last year, over 300 citations were issued locally here just on the Kenai for that violation, and folks really need to be cognizant of it. Before you leave the water that's open to personal use fishing, whether you're standing on shore or in a boat, when you're within that area, by the time you leave, you should have your fish marked and your harvest recorded on that permit.
And the marking is to cutting the tip of the fin?
Correct, cutting both lobes of the tail.
All right. And those instructions all come with the permit, I assume?
They're right on the permit, and they're in the regulation booklet.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us, Robert Begich, biologist with Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Soldotna.
Thank you, and I hope I was helpful.
You were, very much so. And we're going to take a break and be back for the second half of the show talking about Kenai River dip netting with my guest Tim Wilson, who's a fisherman and a sporting goods salesman at B&J Sporting Goods, and Rick Cook, who is the Kenai City Manager. We're going to continue our discussion in just a moment, but now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Calendar. The Talkeetna Birch Festival is this weekend, July 20 and 21, hosted by the Northern Susitna Institute. There will be activities, workshops, and exhibits for the whole family, all in celebration of Alaskan birch. Alaska Geographic will host a field seminar on art in parks and parks in art, conserving America's parks, Tuesday, July 23rd through Thursday, July 25 at Denali National Park and Preserve. Join renowned Alaskan artist Kes Woodward, Denali's former superintendent Paul Anderson, for an exploration into the role that art has and continues to play in preservation and appreciation of our public lands. On July 27, there will be a workshop on Writing the Chugach, led by nature writer Bill Shawanet. Participants in this day-long workshop will learn more about both Anchorage's backyard wilderness and the writing process, from observation to note-taking and journal-keeping, and finally to story. The cost includes pre- and post-trip meetings, a day hike, writing instruction in the Chugach Mountains, and essay critique. And we have links to all of the websites for these activities on our website, which you can find at alaskapublic.org. Finally, the Copper River Wild Festival is coming up July 26 and 27. To tell us a little bit more about the event, we have with us on the phone Kate Morris, who's one of the festival organizers. Thanks for being with us, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
So Cordova is a small town, but you put together a pretty big festival every July.
That's right, because we have a lot to celebrate over here in Cordova, and we like to encourage others to come and visit and support our local businesses and celebrate the salmon that keeps us on the map.
Right. So what are you, you've got a run, and you've got a, tell us about sort of the rundown of what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a two-day weekend festival. It's fun for people of all ages. It kicks off on Friday evening with a Taste of Cordova Seafood Cook-Off. That's sponsored by our local marketing association, and they have some special guest writers, food writers from across the country, as well as chefs who will be at that event providing their feedback on the delicious dishes that have been brought out, and it'll all be taking place by the Beer Garden, sponsored by Alaska Brewing Company. That evening will be rounded out with live music as part of Salmon Jam Music Festival, and the Super Saturated Sugar Strings are our headliner this year, and we're excited to kick up our feet and get a lot of dancing in. Also going on during the music festival, lots of local artisans have their handmade wares for sale, and it's a great opportunity for Cordova to feature their local artists who don't necessarily have their own storefront to promote their goodies, and we also have some great artists coming from out of town that we're really excited about. On Saturday, it's a full day of activity starting in the morning with the Alaska Salmon Runs, and we've got a race for anyone interested in the marathon down to a one-mile fun run, and it's just a great opportunity to explore the Copper River Delta at a much slower pace than when you're driving in your car.
So does the marathon go right out the Copper River Highway there into the Delta?
Yep, it starts at the first major crossing of the Copper River out the 27-mile bridge, and people just run straight back into town. So
It's
a combination of gravel and paved road with glaciers and nesting birds and beaver lodges and potential to see other wildlife, but no guarantee there, but definitely breathtaking views the whole way in. And I think we have at least 30 marathoners already this year signed up, and some folks put their names in at the last minute, but it's pretty neat. Folks who travel from all across the country looking to check Alaska off their list as a state of where they've done a marathon.
Cool.
And then after the runs, we have our education activities, which are free for everybody. There's fish printing sponsored by the Prince William Sound Science Center. The Forest Service has a lot of hands-on activities, learning about fish and different ways to process fish, and you get to try to catch a fish. So that's going on in the afternoon, and we've got a songwriting workshop with Kevin Worrell. And before another night of live music for the second night of Salmon Jam Music Fest. So lots going on. And then, of course, the Copper River Delta and surrounding area of Cordova provides a lot of recreation and sightseeing to be done whenever you have a free moment in your schedule.
Oh, I know. I think Cordova is probably the best outdoor spot just for the variety of things you can do in a small area of anywhere in Alaska. And you have some great fishing there, too, which is our topic today. Just in terms of getting out with the rod and reel.
Absolutely, yeah. There's some lakes that are stocked with trout for the Forest Service. So if you have a young fisherman in your family, that you need to have a high success rate. That's always there's some great trails to hit for that outing. But then some of the other areas, we've got sockeye that can be caught on fly rods and tried on a rod and reel out in some of the other sites on the Delta. So great sightseeing with a chance to get a delicious meal afterwards, too.
What's the best way to get down there? Just take the ferry over from Whittier and get a hotel room or camp out?
Yeah, well, that's certainly an option, and there's daily ferry rides from Whittier straight into Cordova on the fast ferry. It's less than a three-hour ride, so you get some quick wildlife viewing across the Sound. We also have both AeroAlaska and Alaska Airlines offering discount flights for this festival weekend, and there is a local operator who rents vehicles out at the airport if you needed to pick up a vehicle while you're in town, or all of the lodges, the big lodges, provide shuttles so that folks can get to and from town. And we have a shuttle for the festival that will be picking people up from downtown locations to get them up to the festival site, which is at the base of our ski hill.
So, I know when Cordova does something, everybody sort of pitches in, so you don't have to worry too much about getting around. There's always going to be somebody to drive you somewhere or help you out.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's a very, very friendly town, and this time of year we tend to have a lull in the commercial fishery, so between sockeyes and silvers, a lot more folks are around town and looking to catch up with friends and celebrate a successful season so far and get ready for the rest of the season.
Yeah. So this is all July 26 and 27. You can find out about it you can go to alaskapublic.org, our website links to the website for the festival. What is your URL for your website, Kate?
It's copperriverwild.org, and on there are links to the full schedule of events, as well as there are some fees to go to the music festival and to participate in the road races. There's also a lot of free stuff going on for folks, too. And then there's also the link under About Us is where you can find the special code for the Alaska Airlines discount to get discounts on flight over here.
Fantastic. And I know you guys are easy to reach. Your phone number's right there on the website. Well, thanks a lot for being with us,
call
Kate
with
Morse.
Any questions.
Yeah. Thanks for being with us, Kate Morse from the Copper River Wild Salmon Festival in Cordova. And that event and all the others are listed on Outdoor Explorers Calendar at alaskapublic.org. And if you have an event you'd like us to know about or to post it for everybody, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Community Calendar. We're also always interested in your comments and thoughts and events that you can get to us through Facebook. Just go to Outdoor Explorer on Facebook. We do take people's suggestions of guests and shows and always interested in hearing back from you. So, but stay with us now for the second half of the show. We're going to be talking more about dip netting the Kenai when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
And we're back. I'm Charles Wolforth, and the show is Outdoor Explorer. Today, we're talking about dip netting the Kenai River, going down there and getting your freezer full of red salmon. A lot of fun and a lot of fantastic high-value protein that we as Alaskans get to access for, not free, for the cost of the effort and the equipment, but without sort of having to buy it from anyone else. We get to harvest our own resource. And it's a truly Alaskan and truly unique activity. In the studio with me is Tim Wilson, who is an experienced dip netter and sells the equipment at B&J Sporting Goods. And on the phone is Rick Cook, who is the city manager of Kenai. We talked a little bit earlier, Rick, about the impact on the community. I'm sure it's positive impact of having 15,000 people a day there shopping in stores and so forth. But there's an article that the Peninsula Clarion ran, which we've got on our alaskapublic.org website, that about the debate you had last January with your city council and some of the residents who came forward who really are fed up with dip netting. They would really rather it went away completely. And the article talked about some really nasty stuff that people had done with going to the bathroom on people's lawns and noise and all this impact. And I guess tell us about that point of view and how and you know what kinds of negative things are happening that really are affecting people who live there.
Well, there, it's a wide gamut of opinions about the pros and cons of the fishery and how it affects different people in different ways. During the month of July, the mouth of the Kenai River is an area that is fairly heavily recreated by the locals for the most part is deemed kind of unusable. There are just so many people that are down there, and there are some folks that don't like that. They don't like that there are thousands and thousands of folks down there where normally they go for a walk with their dog in the evening. But there are other more tangible negative impacts. Just the trash. The tens of thousands of pounds of trash, other than fish waste, that just gets left behind. There are ironing boards that are used for fish cleaning stations. You name it, it's down there. There are places on the beach where folks will make impromptu toilets rather than go into the bathrooms, that they'll dig a hole and they just get used as toilets, and trash gets disposed of in those holes. And when there's a high tide or a storm, You know, sometimes we find diapers and old clothes and human waste down there, and it's a very small percentage of folks that aren't respectful, like anything. It seems like they're, most of the folks, as long as they have an idea about what is expected and there is some mechanism that they can get stuff to a dumpster or they're more than happy to do that for the privilege of being able to come down and take part in the fishery. And that's 99.9% of the folks that are here couldn't be better visitors to the city of Kenai. But occasionally, like with anything, there are some folks that aren't respectful, and we heard a lot about that from some folks who, as we were having the debate about how we were going to attempt to manage fish waste better this year, so it wasn't quite the negative impact that it's been in the past.
And it's not really your choice, is it, that when the fishery takes place or where it takes place, because it's a state resource. But then you have to enforce the law, have your police down there, and you charge a fee to cover some of the costs.
Well, we try and make it revenue. It's a revenue cost neutral for the city, and it is no small amount of money. And as I gave the one example already, I think last year we collected $362,000 in fees. We spent slightly more than that, just a matter of $5,000 more than that. And so it was a break even year, but that's an awful lot of $20 fees at a time. At the end of the day, you end up collecting that amount of money. So there's a lot going on. Our public safety calls are up by a factor of three during those 3 weeks, be it emergency medical services or police officers. It's a very, very active time frame. And I did want to just touch on one thing that when Robert was on the line and talking about emergency openings going to 24 hours, mm-hmm. the city has every year begged Fish and Game not to do that. And that window from 11 at night till 6 in the morning is really our window to get down there and try and empty dumpsters and pump outhouses and service portable toilets and to rake fish waste down the beach. And when they go to 24 hours, it makes it not only difficult but dangerous to be out there, especially if it's a cloudy night and there are still some amount of people down on the beach trying to fish. And frankly, I don't think they catch any more fish over these last 3 years. If you wanted fish, you could get all the fish you could possibly want without having to be standing out there in that time frame. That it's really our window to try and get in there and do maintenance services.
Mm-hmm. So it's just you can't get down there with equipment because there's too many people around.
Sometimes, and we don't want to run over anybody,
right.
Especially if it's darker, and you've got guys in tractors that are raking that fish waste down the beach, and we got lots of lights and things on them, but we'd prefer to not have to work around people.
I was interested that one of the options you were talking about was actually gathering up the waste in dumpsters and taking it to a plant to be ground up and used as whatever they use fish waste for. Whether it's fertilizer or maybe to be dumped somewhere where it'd have less impact. What was the reasoning behind not adopting that concept?
Some of those are twofold. Some are a matter of cost. We are working with someone to do a puddle pilot project this year, and I think they want about 100,000 pounds of fish waste to use in a composting operation. I thought I had a good idea until the Department of Environmental Conservation decided that any water that was used in fish cleaning stations became a regulated waste stream, and that we had to capture that water and transport it to our wastewater treatment plant
before
it could go. Yeah, so that was that's $250,000 for that little hitch in the get along.
So you're talking about like setting up some fish cleaning tables with this fresh water running across the table,
right,
and then into the river.
Right.
And they said you couldn't do that if you didn't treat the water coming off the table?
Correct.
Oh my gosh. Don't tell anybody about the fish cleaning tables in Homer that run right into the harbor.
Yeah. I think maybe they have, I mean, they may have a pollution discharge elimination system permit to be able to do that.
But, oh really? Okay.
I don't know. And I don't want to create any problems for Homer certainly, but
yeah.
So that we came to a screeching halt on that. I mean, one of the options that we'll continue to explore is having some sort of gathering stations down there where probably just aluminum fish totes or something, and take all those collect and put them on a barge, and you have to head for federal waters. When you get to federal waters, you can dispose of the fish waste in the ocean. You can't do it in the state waters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about 25 miles from here down by Calgon. And the best would be able to find a use for the stuff because the chain of custody is there is no chain of custody, 15,000 different people down there generating fish waste. The only thing it could be used for would be for plant fertilizer, and that's not a very value-added product. And just the effort of that is you're hard pressed to have that pencil out. I mean, it can't be used for either human or animal consumption. The research that we've accomplished, but we're hopeful that someday we'll get to the point that fish waste can be used for some secondary product, whether it's composting or whether it's the manufacture of some fertilizer. I hope someday we get to that. If we can just manage it in the interim, in a way that doesn't result in the really negative the situation we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow, what an interesting thing that you don't think about the impact that something like this has on a community, because we all just think of jumping in the car, right, Tim? You head down there, get some fish, have some fun, come back.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. As far as your fish waste goes, there's a lot of, you can kind of think of creative ways to deal with your fish waste. A lot of people I know, they keep their heads and they keep the parts for making soup stock, stuff like that. I mean, there's got to be something that, the people can do with their fish waste to kind of help clean up the beach a little bit.
Yeah, it's just the fact that it's concentrated because it's natural. It's a natural fish run. It's not enhanced. The fish would be spawning and dying in the river anyway. It's not like we're destroying the river by having fish waste in there. I think it's just the fact that there's that many people doing it right at that particular spot.
Right, absolutely. It gets really concentrated.
Yeah. So, Tim, when you go down, do you just pack up in the morning, drive down to Kenai, fish, and get back to Anchorage in the evening? Or do you or most people, you think, like, camp out when they're down there?
Most people bring their motor homes. They make a weekend of it. They stay. It's kind of a long run to do in a day.
Yeah.
So most families are going down there for a couple days at the most. And, they're spending time in their motor home or, at hotels or what have you.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of equipment to get started in this? You have to buy it. You can't rent it anywhere. You got to buy the equipment or make it yourself.
Yeah, that's correct. There's several different ways you can make your own. You can do aluminum conduit. You can make your own net with a pipe bender. You just got to get the yoke and the handles and all that. But it's a lot easier just to buy the setup. You can get a four to five foot hoop with poles. Generally they range between 6 and 12 feet. So as long as you have between 12 and 20 feet of reach out into the water, you're good. And then a handle that's in line with the rim of the net, so you know if your net is upright in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, chest waders, gloves that go up to your shoulder is a real plus. It kind of keeps all the fish waste off your arms and keeps you dry. I'd recommend a life jacket to anybody going out in the water. Absolutely. Other than that, just lots of trash bags, a good fillet knife, a good sharpener, a cooler, lots of ice. You want to keep your fish fresh. You don't want it going bad on the way home.
Yeah, those neoprene waders are good if you're going to be standing out there for a while so you don't just freeze.
Absolutely. Neoprene waders are good. The only problem with neoprene waders is they stay wet. So once you bring them out of the water, I recommend having some sort of dry bag you can put them into. Otherwise, they'll create a lot of a mess in your truck or in your motorhome.
Right, right. So that conduit, the guys who sell it commercially, do they use conduit as well to build the nets?
The ones we sell, it's actually a solid bar, kind of like conduit, but you can buy conduit at any hardware store, yeah, along with the pipe bender and stuff to make it.
Yeah. Well, conduit's not very strong. And part of the thing that people might not realize is that you really are not using any leverage on this net. You're just putting it in the river, and then when you get hit with a fish, you're just pulling it out, right? You're never trying to lever it.
Not really. Some people walk up and down the beach, but most people just stand there. The most stress you put on the net is when you get fish in the net, you turn it one way or the other, so the fish get trapped and
so
then
you close
pulling
the
it
net
out.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then you just sort of pull it back until you got the fish on the beach, and then you have to dispatch the fish.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd recommend having a club on your belt loop.
Mm-hmm. So what's the, how much does one of these nets cost to sort of getting set up?
They range. You can build your own net for anywhere between, $60 and $80. If you want to just forego all that effort, you can buy a net. A 4-foot net costs $84.95 at B&J's. A 5-foot hoop costs $130 at B&J's.
Mm-hmm. And when you're fishing with these nets, I mean, you're talking about 4 or 5, that's a big piece of net, That's the diameter of the actual net part where the fish would swim in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then the pole is pretty long.
Yep.
20 foot.
The poles are generally, the ones we sell are 6 feet long, and I recommend people always have, 2 to 3 of them so they can get far enough out, and they can get far enough out without having to actually go out in the water too far and risk their own safety.
Yeah. So how far, when you're fishing, how far out would you stand? How, the water up to your hips? Or?
Yeah, I don't like to go too far on the water. Generally about, up to your hips or waist is good. And then, your pole will extend another 12 to 20 feet out in the water.
Mm-hmm. And you're just trying to get to where those fish are going to be migrating up the way. And if you're in the wrong spot, you probably won't have much luck.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people kind of have the mentality of, the farther out you get, the better fishing is, which is true. When there's several people fishing next to you and you're all fishing at the same distance out in the water, the first one in the stream of fish is going to catch the fish, and then the people behind them are going to get, are not going to get any. So, the farther out in the water generally is the better you can.
Yeah,
you have better results.
So when the fish are coming, they'll kind of come all at once, right? I mean, they get really hot, and then or is it sort of stay hot all the time?
Generally, it goes by the tides. About 2 hours before high tide, and then high tide, and then it's really hot during slack tide, and then about 2 hours after high tide is generally the best fishing.
So this, in terms of this nighttime fishing, maybe that's why people want to go, because that's when the tides are happening.
Yeah, it depends, but nighttime fishing, it can be dangerous. Like it was said earlier, it can be dark. There's a lot of things going on, and you don't really catch any more fish at night. It's just a chance for people to go down and do what is called a suicide run. Go down and catch all your fish in one day and get back to town.
Yeah, yeah. I had a friend who used to do that when I worked at the newspaper. And yeah. He says, "Hey, let's go. We'll get off work at 7. And said, so, "Okay, well, I'll try anything new." And it was good. We were going down to the Russian, but it was, by the time I was actually fishing, I was so tired.
Absolutely.
I couldn't sink straight. I maybe got one fish, and then I just fell asleep on the ground. But he was a maniac. He fished all night. We got back to town and went straight to work. We never went home.
Yeah, I've done that several times. It's a lot of fun when you're rod and reel fishing because you get to hang out with your buddies. But when it comes to dip netting, it's just too far of a run, too many fish to clean. It's just, too much of a pain in the butt.
Too much effort, and it's
Absolutely.
Physical work.
Absolutely.
It's physical work doing that kind of fishing.
Yeah, it's, it's 90% work. You have a lot of fun catching the fish, but then when you get home, that's when the real work starts, all the processing.
Yeah,
can take a lot of your
well,
time
that's
off.
What I found is that the actual fishing is so quick and so fun that it's very easy to get out of control in terms of how many fish you get, and then the work aspect overtakes it. And by the time you're done, you may be miserable, and you may not even be able to finish that fish over the winter. So you really have to think about, don't catch too many fish.
Absolutely, yeah. You stay within your limitations. There's a lot of families out there that can eat that much fish over the period, over the winter. But just stay within your limitations.
Yeah, yeah. So Rick, we were talking a little bit about the hazards of people. A lot of people standing in deep moving water. Do you guys have a number of rescues that you are doing during the course of the summer?
Oh, every year there'll be folks get out there too far and they get bobbing along, and we'll go out there and drag them out of the water. It's not uncommon at all. And in fact, I've even seen, you know, a person out there that had a net that they were in a dry suit and they had fins and they went swimming across the mouth of the river trying to get fish. So, you know, there's lots of entertaining activity that happens there. Just a moment ago, I thought of something that I don't think that Mr. Beggett said, and he was on the line, but, you know, they've made it where you can't retain kings, so you catch kings. And just so I understand, it's clear, you're not supposed to remove them from the water. If they're in your net, you're not supposed to drag them up on a beach. You're not supposed to pick them out of the water. You're supposed to take them out of your net and resuscitate them while they're still in the water and not come out.
Hmm. Challenging for most people, I would say.
I would think so. And I know that enforcement is way up this year. I've been watching the Kasilof River stuff. There was probably 60 citations in the paper for people not marking their tags. So, as Robert was talking about, make sure you mark your tags and you clip your fins on your fish before you leave the fishing area, because I think there's a real renewed effort or a new effort that Fish and Game has a much more significant presence here.
Yeah, we did an earlier show on these kings. Where are they? What's happening? And it seems like it's still a mystery. Still a mystery about why the kings are absent from Cook Inlet.
Yeah, and I don't have any guesses about that either. I mean, if you're involved in one segment of the industry, you know, be it commercial, be it sport fish, it always, you know, it's somebody else.
That's right.
It's not them. So, you know, hopefully they'll sort it out and they can find a way to reconstitute the value of that king fishery. I mean, it's a shame. It's the Kenai River is unique in the whole world, not just unique in Alaska or the United States. I mean, it is a phenomenal gift that we have here in the state.
It is, and it's a real a heartbeat and lifeblood of your community and of Soldotna and of the entire peninsula. And I think Anchorage people feel like it's our river too. So I appreciate your forbearance on the behalf of all the Anchorage residents. Thank you, Kenai, for putting up with us, because I know that we're the yahoos who are coming down there and messing everything up, and we appreciate your hospitality. Thanks very much, Rick Cook, for being with us, the city manager of Kenai.
Well, thank you, and you have a good day and have a good season of dip netting and fishing.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Tim Wilson, great job. Thanks for telling us about dip netting. And he's with B&J Sporting Goods, which is there at Northern Lights and C Street, and is also just a fisherman and enjoys it. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me in tight lines, everybody.
Yeah. And earlier we heard from Robert Begich, who's with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game there in the Soldotna office, and Kate Morse in Cordova talking about the festival that they've got coming up in another week or so. Next week's show, we'll be talking about day hiking in Anchorage. We're a unique city where you can live a totally urban lifestyle, but get into the alpine high country within an hour from anywhere you might find yourself. Somehow, it can be easy to forget how close you are to that stress relief, so we're going to try to remind you. We'd love to hear your ideas, too, about favorite hikes and how to get there. Our only limitation is you have to be able to do it in a day or less, starting from Anchorage. Share at Outdoor Explorer on Facebook. That's all for today's show. Thanks to our producer, Kristen Speck, and audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Charles Woolforth. Till next week, I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.